Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 29 of the Theatrical Mustang Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Woodzik. This interview is with Amy Wheeler, and she's a playwright, she's an actress, and she's the executive director of Hedgebrook and also an alumna of that residency program. And this is a really dynamic interview about how she was originally an actress, and then she transitioned into playwriting, and now after a break from treading the boards, she's going to be back playing Prospero in Island Shakespeare Festival's production of The Tempest this summer. And at the same time, Theater 22 in Seattle is producing her play Whizzer Pizzer at the 12th Avenue Arts Space. So it's a really busy artistic summer for her, and she's just frickin' awesome, and I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. We have links in the episode description so you can get all the information about both productions. Check them both out. This episode is sponsored by KLM XYZ Creative Communications. Please consider using them for all of your graphic design, web design, and marketing needs. KLMXYZ.com. And also by the second annual Queer Pride Parade on Whidbey Island. That's happening August 2nd. And it's free to participate in. So if you want to march in the parade, or if you just want to watch, or if you want to volunteer, you can visit queerparade.com to get more information on that. So without any further ado, please enjoy episode 29 with Amy Wheeler. I'm very excited to welcome Amy Wheeler to the podcast. Welcome, Amy!
Thank you, Katie.
So you have a lot of stuff going on right now, theatrically speaking.
I do.
So I think first let's talk about Whizzer Pizzer. That's okay. Going to be opening on July 10th at 12th Avenue Arts, produced by Theater 22. Uh-huh. Talk about what's been the arc of this play?
Well, I wrote this play a long time ago at this point, actually, when I was living in Iowa, and when Dr. Laura was kind of at her peak,
right,
and had come out and said that homosexuals are biological errors, which pushed all my buttons. So I started it then, but it's one of the, I mean, I've learned over my career that it takes a long time to actually write plays, that you write them and then the world changes or you change and you rewrite them. So it was produced, really beautiful production by Seven Stages in Atlanta, some years ago now. I can't remember exactly what year, but so when I met Corey and Albert, Corey McDaniels and Albert Sukapira, his partner who founded Theater 22, they were interested in that play, and I said, great, but I think if we produce it now and in Seattle, now that we have marriage equality, and you know, I'm going to want to do some rewriting and make sure that it's current and relevant. And so we've been doing that in the rehearsal process, and it's been really amazing to see it kind of come to life now and, you know, be as relevant and in some ways even more so, I think, than it was when I wrote it.
Were you involved at all in the casting process?
Yes, I was to some extent. My dear friend, Eric Mulholland.
We love Eric.
We love Eric. Is playing the lead role, and he's been working with me on this play for the last couple of years.
Wow.
On this role in just in some readings in my home and working with different actors, but just to really explore this character. So it's so cool to see him getting to play with other actors and a director and really bring it to life. I was in on auditions, and I'm thrilled by this cast. This cast is awesome.
They Talk are about the
amazing.
Cast. Who's in the
well,
cast?
Well, so Rhonda Sikowski and Alyssa Keene are two of my favorite actresses in Seattle who I have been wanting to work with for years. We're colleagues. We both have taught at Cornish together. I've known their work. They've actually both been in readings of Whizzer Pizzer at different points in its life in Seattle. But I hadn't had a chance to do a production with them. So when they auditioned and were available, I was thrilled. And then we've brought some other awesome people into the cast who are new to me, and some of them are actually kind of new to Seattle, but who, when they walked in and auditioned, I was just like, oh my God,
that's it.
This is the person I see in my head when I hear this role. So they're fantastic, and they're such a great ensemble. Just when I go to rehearsal and get to watch them work together, they're having so much fun, and they're finding so much, you know, it's a comedy, so they're kind of digging that, but they're getting the deeper themes in it too. And then I have to say, Corey McDaniel's just a dream director. He's also an actor. He was in Theater 22's last production, Live from the Last Night of My Life.
Oh, yeah.
Play.
Yeah.
So he gets he gets how to work with actors and is so fun and interactive, but he's also brilliant at creating these stage pictures. He does it all at the same time, and I've just been kind of amazed watching him in rehearsal. And some fantastic designers. I mean, just the whole team is, they're incredible.
How often have you been attending rehearsals?
Just, you know, I've just dropped in periodically just to, I did some rewriting in the beginning, and then I dropped in for a rehearsal, a run through, stumble through actually last week when they were going through it for the designers. And we actually even cut out an entire scene after I saw it that night just for the flow of it. And everybody's being so cool and game and going with that. And then I probably won't see it again till opening night at this point, just given my schedule. So,
wow.
Yeah.
So what is the play about? What is the little blurb that would be in the arts and entertainment section in the local paper or whatnot?
So it's about one night in the life of a gay man who's going through an identity crisis that gets kicked off when he performs Somewhere Over the Rainbow as an homage to Judy Garland at the beginning of the play, and it goes terribly wrong. But also he's just in that place in his life where he's like not happy with the way things are and knowing he needs to evolve and not quite knowing how to do it. So different incidents happen that send him on this journey, and it's kind of a reverse Oz story. Kind of, he's like Dorothy going through this, this whole kind of crazy journey, that he comes out on the other side, a different person. And I don't want to give too much more away than that, but it's mirroring that journey. And that, The Wizard of Oz is such an iconic, mythic story for the gay community.
Right.
That idea of trying to find somewhere where we can belong, where somewhere that's home, and to create family. And and of course there's the rainbow, and there's like so many things that we've drawn on throughout history for gay culture with this story. So it's really cool to find those resonances for a man who's exploring what it means to love himself, and then to be able to let other people love him and love them too. So it's about love.
It's a great play. I mean, I've had the honor of reading at a couple of the dance hall
fabulous
meetings. And so it opens again July 10th and runs through August 1st.
Yes.
And people are going to want to get tickets and info, and they can visit theater22.org, and we'll have all that information in the episode description.
Yes.
But not only do you have a production going up in Seattle, but at the same time, you're going to be acting as Prospero in The Tempest on the island. So how the heck did that happen?
So Island Shakespeare Festival does phenomenal theater out here on Whidbey in the summer. And last summer I went to see the production of Richard, and those actors walked out on the stage, ran out on the stage with such energy and passion. And there was just the young man playing Richard, Jimmy Dix, who sadly is not with us any longer. But he had such fire in his eyes when he walked out on stage and he kicked the play off. I just like, literally it took my breath away. And I just turned to my wife, Kate was sitting next to me, and I just said, oh, I want to act again. And she was like, okay. And then as the play went on, I just was riveted. And at one point I turned to her again and said, but I want to be Richard. because really I haven't acted in a long time. I moved into playwriting. That's been a more satisfying journey for me, because I felt like, when I was acting earlier in my life, I was younger, and the kinds of roles that women were able to audition for were not fulfilling to me. I looked like an ingenue, but inside I was not an ingenue. I felt like roles were demeaning to women.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a different time in the 80s and 90s, and I kind of left acting. But as I watched it, I thought, to be able to play a role like that, and with all of the complexities of it and the energy of it, that would get me. So I walked out of the tent that evening and I saw Rose Woods, who's the artistic director and founder of ISF. And I just said, I want to act again. You just made me want to act again with this production. But I want to play Richard. And we just laughed. Ha ha ha. So about a month later, Rose got in touch with me and said, I am thinking about doing a mostly female production of The Tempest next year. If I do that, would you play Prospero?
I just got shivers.
I know. I did too. I was just like, really? And you've never even seen me act. And she had seen me do the WOW Talks, which is takes place at Whidbey Island Center for the Arts. And it's
Women of Whidbey?
Women of Whidbey, right, is what WOW stands for, right. And so I had done a talk last year, and this is this amazing thing where women just stand up and tell their stories, kind of a mini TED Talk kind of thing, but really your personal story. And she had seen me do that and said she was sitting in the audience and just said, I want to work with this woman. She needs to act again. So she had kind of had it in her mind too. And when she said Prospero, I was just like, yes, I'm in. But to be honest, I The Tempest is not a play that I knew really well, because I think I'd always seen it as a male role.
Right.
And kind of an older guy too, you know. I love Julie Taymor's film with Helen Mirren.
Right.
Which really kind of rocked my world a couple of years ago when that came out. But I hadn't ever paid the kind of attention to this play that now that I'm working on it, I'm in love with it. I think it's his greatest work. It's so complex and magical and about everything that it is to be human. And, you know, so I'm loving the ride. I'm loving it.
What has that been like for you, taking, 15, 20 years off of acting?
Yeah.
Right? And stepping back.
Yeah, I was like 15 when I left.
But stepping back into that, were you nervous?
I totally panicked after I said yes. because even though in my role with Hedgebrook, I do a lot of public speaking and I'm very comfortable doing that, but I hadn't taken on another character before. And honestly, just the size of this role, the magnitude of it and the lines. I was talking with an acting coach, C. Glassman, in Los Angeles in the spring when I was there, and I was like, it's a big role. And she was like, yeah, it's like Hamlet with more lines. It's like, oh my God. So just the sheer, like, memorizing that many lines, because with ISF, it's summer rep, you know, we have a 3-week rehearsal period at the most, and you have to come into rehearsal completely memorized. And I hadn't memorized that much text in a very long time and that kind of language. So I kind of freaked out a little bit. I went to Rose and was like, I don't know if I can do this. And she said, yes, you can. Just breathe. Keep working on it. And then, you know, she's been awesome. We've been meeting and talking about it. And I did find that as I started working on it, it sort of reactivated those brain cells. So not only has the language been actually easier to memorize, I think, than non-Shakespearean language, it's actually, I've started to remember monologues I memorized in my 20s and used to do as audition pieces or when I was acting before. All of a sudden I can remember those things too. So it's like opened up this whole other part of my creative brain. I'm writing more now. I mean, it's just been, it's kind of, it's been a whole huge, big life thing to do. Way more than I expected.
Who are you working with? Who is the cast? Some of your castmates for The Tempest?
Olena Hodges is playing Ariel. And Valerie
Huntington,
thank you, is playing Caliban, which is super cool. I mean, they're both so talented. And to be working with women in those roles, and particularly Caliban, because often Ariel is cast as a woman, but we're having really interesting conversations about what it means for Caliban to be a woman, for Prospero to be enslaving another woman, and also Caliban's relationship to Miranda. It just brings up all kinds of interesting female dynamics, and gender and sexuality dynamics. It's just very interesting. It's a super talented cast. Many of them come out of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and the
Southern Oregon University.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but it's clearly a really awesome training program, because many of them are coming there from there. Anna Dunwilder and Sazie. I don't know people's last names yet because we just started rehearsal, but you know, they're so awesome as Trinculo and Stefano. and then what's interesting in the casting is that she has cast the male roles that actors, the king and my brother and the guys who are on the ship, the shipwreck. And so it's like this invasion of male energy into this female
matriarchal island.
Yeah. So it's very much about those dynamics of patriarchy and matriarchy, and also a woman who has been banished for being a sorceress, for having magical power that was, you know, they had to take her power away and send her off to this island for 12 years.
Wow.
And so for 12 years, she's been perfecting her magic, which I feel is really like quantum physics. Like she's been learning how to use the natural elements to create storms and, you know, and she causes this tempest to happen to bring them there so that she can resolve her past, ultimately ask for and give forgiveness, and bring her daughter back home and back into the culture. So that's a beautiful story. And Rose is an awesome director. She's just getting beautiful performances out of people.
I'm so excited to see it.
No, I can't wait to do it.
And that opens July 17th?
Yes.
And then runs through
September 13th in rep with Three Musketeers. So you've got, on one hand, you've got that story going on, and then you have this swashbuckling, you know, very male story going on with Three Musketeers. It should be really fun.
And people can go to islandshakespearefest.org if they want to get more information.
Yes.
We'll have, again, that information in the episode description. It's a new location this year,
it
right?
It is. It's really exciting. We're still under a tent, but there's the city of Langley has given us a big field with surrounded by, you know, big cedars and firs. So I don't want to give too much away about the set, but it's awesome. And Rose has opened up the back of the tent, so you're looking out onto these trees. So it really has that magical island feel to it, you know. I mean, the world of the play is right around us all the time. So I was working on one of my monologues recently. I was in Oklahoma visiting my father, who just turned 80, and I was in my parents' backyard in Oklahoma City. And it was like 2 a.m, and I was working on the Ye Elves of Hills, Brooks, Standing Lakes, and Groves, the whole incantation monologue, and the wind started to pick up. And then I started seeing these little flashes of light, and I looked around, and there were fireflies around me. And I haven't seen fireflies since I was a kid, but all of a sudden they were there. I was like, oh my gosh, there's magic in them words, you know? I mean, it just feels like it's a... there's an energy in this play that I really do feel like a spell is cast with the audience. And I can't wait to see what happens when we start performing.
It's exciting.
It is.
I think that's a good transition to you being a little Spitfire in Oklahoma growing up. Can we go there next?
Sure. Yeah.
So you grew up in Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
Brothers and sisters?
Yes. I have a sister, Marlo, and a brother, Paul.
And your father was... a pastor.
He was. He, he told me recently that he retired when I was, a junior in high school. So my whole growing up, he was a Methodist minister and we lived all over the state of Oklahoma as he traveled to different churches. But he left the ministry pretty much because he was pretty progressive liberal guy, has really been an activist. He and my mom both, on behalf of me and Kate and my wife, as we've been able to get married, he actually, you know, officiated our ceremony in 2007 when he risked his pension with the Oklahoma Methodist Church to do that.
Wow.
And that's only just changed, like just changed where that could happen. So he really left because the church was not, he felt like, being on the right side of history in terms of civil rights and everything. But he said he really just stopped being paid to be a minister, that he feels like that's still, in a lot of ways, who he is. And that definitely has influenced my writing and what I write about. And there's always, it seems like very often in my plays right now anyway, there's themes of religion and sexuality kind of clashing and coming together. And then my mom is a dramatist. My mom studied acting. She sings.
I don't think I knew that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
When I know that we're leopard print twins, me and your mother.
Yeah, but she loves that.
And so that, I mean, it was just all performance in different forms was all around you growing up. Yes.
Performance and ritual, you know, just being in the church every Sunday. And so there's something about all of that that's very sacred to me. I've always felt like theater is my church.
I feel the same way.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Like it's profane, and I feel like you can speak the truth in theater in a way that you really can't in church, for me anyway, growing up as a gay person who couldn't be who I was in that environment. But the ritual, the pageantry, the music, the collective communal people coming together to enact and tell stories and go through an experience together, it for me is very rooted in the church. Although I don't go to church anymore, I go to theater, so, you know. But I think we have to have places as a culture where we can be in dialogue and wrestle with our demons and figure stuff out. And I really do believe that theater has the potential to change people in an evening, in one experience, you know. That happened for me when I saw Cloud Nine when I was in college.
Yeah.
Carol Churchill.
Yeah.
And that play just rocked my world as a young person who had not yet figured, well, who kind of knew I was gay but was not ready to say that. And the way she deals with gender and sexuality in that play historically and then in the present. And then years later, Angels in America came along.
Right.
So Cloud Nine made me go, okay, I have to be in theater and be an actor and really commit to that. Angels in America was, okay, now I need to write plays. I need to have a voice because you can bring all of these things together in one play. And look at what that play has done in our lifetimes in terms of opening up a dialogue around these things. And, you know, politics, gender, sexuality, religion, you know, angels, all of it.
Can you remember the first time you performed on stage as a little kid? Was it a church pageant?
Yeah, I definitely did. I can't really remember the first, but we did a lot of play acting. My mom would direct a lot of them.
Or maybe what was the first time that you were on stage and you were like, yeah, I gotta keep doing this. Like you felt that inner bell or that excitement of this is something I really want to keep doing in my life.
Definitely high school. I was in, you know, from freshman year, I was in the chorus of Camelot, and I had an immediate experience with that and then went to New York when I was like 17. We had this amazing drama teacher, Diane Perkins, who came in and took this group of Oklahoma kids and just like blew our minds about what theater could be. And then took us to New York and we saw Sweeney Todd on Broadway in the afternoon. And that evening we saw The Fantastics off Broadway.
Oh my
gosh. To have those two experiences, iconic shows, and that were like, oh, this is how huge and magnificent and theatrical a world can be. And then this is how intimate and theatrical and moving,
right.
You know? And then, so I was a sophomore that year, and then she directed The Fantastics my senior year and cast me as Louisa with an amazing cast, but including two other people who had been two dear friends of mine, Rick Finifrock and Robin Arn, who had been, oh, and John Hansen, who had all gone on that trip to New York when we were sophomores. As seniors, we got to play that. And that was huge for me. So that was very, that was pivotal. And then that same year, I got to play 80 Annie in Oklahoma, which was just a rip and just so much fun. But that's really when I went, okay, I want to go to college and study acting, which I did at the University of Kansas. And I mean, it was my trajectory from that point on.
What were some of your favorite roles from college?
Agnes in Agnes of God.
Mm-hmm.
The chorus in Antigone, Ennui's Antigone, where the chorus has those monologues directly to the audience. And the director, Ron Willis, who ran the theater department at that point, had me perform it like Laurie Anderson. He put this body mic on me so that I didn't have to project. I could talk at this very low, but I would fill, my voice would just fill this auditorium.
Right.
And just the power of that, of having people like in the palm of your hand that way. Let's see, Babe in Crimes of the Heart. and which you've done that play too.
Yep. That's a fun one. I got to play Meg, and Anna, who's playing Trinculo, got to play Babe in that production.
You guys were awesome.
Directed by Rosewood. Yeah. And Melanie Lowy, because she was our other sister.
There you go.
Okay, now we've mentioned everyone.
Great cast. and I also played Cordelia in a Kabuki King Lear in college.
Oh, fascinating.
Which was really cool. So I went from there to New York. I studied at the Chautauqua Theater Company in the summer. And then I went to New York. And like I said, I didn't do as much acting in New York as I wanted to. I did get to be, I was in a really cool production of Blood Wedding. And I was in this evening of two plays, No Exit and Beckett's play, which both of them are set in hell. And they're both two women and a man. So we had the same cast perform those two shows back to back, and they're both short, and we called it A Night in Hell, which was just totally fun. So the things I did do, I loved, but there were so many things, like I said, that I auditioned for that I was like, oh, even if I was cast in this, I wouldn't really want to do it.
Well, it reminds me a little bit of, I've been obsessed with Fun Home ever since won the Tony for Best Musical, and Beth Malone, who plays the eldest Allison in there, she went to University of Northern Colorado, and which Andy Walker did as well, and she came back and talked to the undergraduates there, and she said that as a gay woman who's in musical theater professionally, and you have to play all these ingenue roles, the only way that she can make it work within herself is pretending that she's a drag queen. And that's the way she's able to sort of distance it from herself because it's different from who she is. And just talking about how she's so grateful to have this chance to play like a strong butch role where it's she can really be herself.
See, that's exactly it. I mean, I felt like I had to, like, I had this inner tomboy that I had to, like, completely squelch when I went in for auditions. And this was in the time that you still had to wear, like, pantyhose. Do you know what I mean? Which, don't even get me started about wearing pantyhose. But talk about drag. But it was just, it literally was, like, I was having to make myself up to look and be different. And I was in a relationship with a woman, but I wasn't out to my family I wasn't completely out yet. So it was very schizophrenic, you know, and there weren't roles that felt like me where I could actually be myself, you know? And I think there's more of that now, and certainly more of us, or, you know, more women and more gay people are writing roles, and transgender people are writing roles. So we get to be ourselves on stage. But I also say that I am grateful to Rose for seeing Prospero in me and basically, you know, drawing that out in me. And I very much feel her masculine energy and her maternal, I'm doing this and I have to protect my daughter energy. It's all there because we're complex. Human beings are complex animals, you know, and to have to squelch one part of you, I didn't feel like I was able to bring my full humanity to my acting. And acting is so hard, auditioning is so hard, you're putting your physical, your being out there all the time, you know, in auditions. And it's so hard to make that not personal if you don't get something in a way that writing, you send it out and you don't get it, but it's not like you standing in the room, you know? And it was just, it was hard. I just wasn't cut out for it in that way. But I love acting. So I hope to do more of it.
Will you please tell the story of how you wrote your first play, because it's one of my favorite Amy Wheeler part of the Amy Wheeler mythology. I just love it so much.
Oh, that's awesome, yeah. It was a new thing for me, actually, because I was so uncomfortable in my skin as an actor. And so it was right around the time I was turning 30, and I thought, okay, I need to try this playwriting thing out. So I went to Playwrights Horizons and I signed up for a class. And as I was signing up and filling out the paperwork, I noticed this flyer on the bulletin board, literally like right in front of me, that was about this new theater company called New Georges that had just been founded and had their first production up. And it was devoted to producing work by women. And the production was happening at the theater downstairs. So I was like, well, cool, I need to go check that out. So before the class started, and it was a class with Cassandra Medley, who I've since gotten to know. She's a Hedgebrook alum, and I studied with her in grad school. But anyway, so I went to the show, and it was great. At intermission, I asked if the artistic director, Susan Burnfield, was there, and somebody pointed her out. And I went over and introduced myself, and she said, "Hey, so great. So what do you do?" And I just said, "I'm a playwright." I hadn't even started the class yet, but it was like I was trying this on. It was like, I'm going to see what this feels like. And she said, "Oh, really? Well, fantastic. So we have this space at Alice's fourth floor in 2 weeks, and we're doing an evening of short plays by women. Do you have something?" And I was like, "Sure." And she goes, "Well, great. This is like a Friday." And she said, "Great. Well, send it to me by Monday. And if you're in it, you know, we'll talk and help you cast it and everything." So I went home and wrote my first play that weekend. And that I gave it to her on Monday. It's called Intersection. I then started the class with Cassandra. So that helped me like flesh it out. But I literally started with just two women on a street corner in New York arguing over something in a trash can. And I didn't know who the women were or why they were arguing, but I just started with a conflict and let it flow out of that. And so we ended up doing a stage reading of it in that slot 2 weeks later, and then a full production of it within the year happened at the Greenwich Street Theater with my friend Julina Tatlock directing it. And then Julina and a producer ended up approaching me about adapting it for the screen. And then she directed the short film of it. And all of that happened within like a year. And then I went to grad school from there. I wrote my first full-length play right after that, which I started in Cassandra's class. And the first reading of that in New York, the lead role was read by Viola Davis, who had just come out of Juilliard, who was phenomenal even then. But I was just like blown away to have her even at that time. It was so clear that she was such an extraordinary talent. And it got a huge positive response at this reading in New York. But it's a play about race set in the South. And I went to Iowa, to University of Iowa in the Playwrights Workshop. And I worked on it there, and I ended up directing a kind of a workshop production with students there. I don't want to say it wasn't well received. It was in some respects, but I had a very difficult dialogue with students of color in the grad program with me who had come from New York and San Francisco and who had a lot of issues with the play. And it was good for me. It was a really difficult growth moment where I had to, as a woman who had written this play that was outside my culture, the lead character is an African-American woman from New York who's in seminary, who is gay. So there are definitely elements of me in her, but also definitely elements of, not of me. I went through a really challenging kind of confrontation with them around that play and ended up feeling like maybe I shouldn't be working on this. Maybe I don't have the right to tell this story. Or maybe now is not the time to tell it, because it's a confrontation between that woman and a middle-aged white guy who's very racist and also very homophobic. And so it's a really provocative play. But I basically put it in a drawer and it's never been produced. And since then, some of the students in that dialogue with me who were the most vehement about it, I've re-encountered them as professionals out in the world, and they've actually said to me, it wasn't so much the play, it was the time and the place where we encountered it. It was being in Iowa, in the 90s, where they were some of the only students of color in the department, and they were coming from these urban areas where that had not been true.
Right.
And so we've had a different conversation about it since then, and I toy with the idea of going back to the play and working on it again now, but it was interesting. It was an interesting experience to write something and then have to sort of stand behind it, but also to really listen to the feedback and say, "I hear you, and maybe now's not the time for this play."
Yeah.
And we'll see if it has its time. I don't know.
Taking just a quick step back, what was the timeline of between writing your first play, taking that first class, and then making the decision to apply for and then being accepted to such a prestigious playwriting program?
It was like a year. I wrote the, I mean, all of it happened.
Shut the front door.
So that's the thing that I learned from it is by claiming I'm a playwright and stepping into that and saying, this is who I am. And then showing up and like, you know, writing it and like putting it out there very quickly. Everything started to happen. Everything flowed out of that. So I actually, so Intersection was produced and I decided I wanted to go to grad school. I was working at the Paul Taylor Dance Company in fundraising. Mm-hmm. It was a great job. But I was kind of itching to write more. I didn't have a lot of time to write at that time. I got into Yaddo and I went for a residency there and, worked on this play I was just talking about. And then, I just thought, you know, I really need to know if this is going to be my life and I need to space and time to just write and figure that out. So it had passed the deadlines for all of the other programs except for Iowa. They had a spring deadline and everything else had passed. So I called them and they said, look, our deadline is tomorrow, but we'll fax you the stuff. If you fill it out and fax it right back to us, we will consider it. So I did that. And 2 weeks later, I got a call from Sherry Kramer, who was running the program at the time, inviting me to come. And then it took me 2 weeks to say yes, because I was so freaked out that it happened that quickly. And right. I literally would have to have, I needed to move in a month if I said yes.
Yeah.
But I did. I said yes. And I moved my life out there and it was absolutely the right thing to do. So say yes.
Say yes. What's your writing process like as a playwright? Does it start with an idea? Do characters come to you?
It comes in different ways. A lot of times I feel like I'm responding to myth, and that can be contemporary myth like The Wizard of Oz, or I've written a play in response to Medea, but that's not about Medea. It's about, Susan Smith, the young woman in South Carolina who drowned her children in the early 90s.
Right.
Her two little boys. It's so often it's responding to something that's happened or happening in the culture. I think I start with ideas first, but characters come to me very quickly. And I tend to write a first draft very quickly, but it takes me a long time and many, many, many drafts to get to finish it or to get to a place where I feel like it's ready for production. I write more quickly when I'm actually working with a director and actors. I think because I started as an actor that when I'm in that energy and in the room, like now that I'm in rehearsal for Wizard Pizzer and The Tempest, I'm writing all kinds of stuff. I've got like, you know, and also working on The Tempest and it being supposedly the last play Shakespeare wrote that was produced anyway, and kind of his farewell to his life as a playwright. I'm so aware of him as I go through the play and him sort of having to let go of parts of himself or reckon with parts of himself. And that's really inspiring me as a writer. And also just how spare he is. Like his language is very big, but the opening is just, you know, there's a tempest, there's mm-hmm. a storm and boom, you're in a storm and they're in it and they're dealing with it. And then then the next thing you realize that storm was caused by this person, you know, and just the way the story flows out of action, that is actually very simple and direct and you have to kind of keep up with it. I think that's the breathless quality of watching Shakespeare when it's done really well is that it's you're on this ride and you have to kind of keep, you know, moving with it.
It's sort of, it was the summer blockbuster of the time that he was writing,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. And that's the way Rose is directing it too. She just keeps saying, take the air out of it and just you run on your interest. You know, there's no walking or thought. There's moments where you can drop in and take that pause or that moment, but you have to completely earn it, you know? And I love that. It's very physical.
I was like trying to see the picture in my head, and so I got like stunned for a minute, like a bird who hits a window pane. Sorry about that. Can you talk about the relationship between your acting and your writing, and how one feeds the other?
Well, I think again, just being as in a process as an actor, physically again right now, is causing me to go back to the play that I've been working on for a very long time and that I know has been, and it's called right now Atomic Agape, although I may be changing the name. But it's a play I've been writing for a while that has been full of ideas that are very epic, and people respond to the ideas but have also said, but where's, we need the action in the story. So I'm writing a draft of it right now that's coming to me so easily, where I'm stripping it of everything but action and trusting that the ideas are in that. And I'm coming at it more as an actor than a writer. I'm coming at it more like, okay, if I were embodying this character, you know, and what happens next, and how do I surprise the audience with things or stay one step ahead of them? And so I'm having the experience sitting at my desk and writing that I'm having when I'm up on my feet in rehearsal at the Tempest under the tent, you know, with acting. And so it's really making me want to act more, but it's infusing my writing with this new energy that I'm just, I didn't expect, and I'm just so thrilled by, you know. It's fun.
I'm excited for all of it.
Yay, me too.
So I thought we could talk a little bit about Hedgebrook, since we're at Hedgebrook. Yes. And it's the middle of the application season for the Writers in Residence program. Mm-hmm. Do you want to give the arc of your Hedgebrook relationship, your Hedgebrookship?
Hedgebrookship, that's so great. You know, Hedgebrook has been my arc for the last almost, well, decade, over a decade. I came here as a writer in 2002 and did a residency. I joined the board in 2003 as the organization was making this transition from being a private foundation to a nonprofit charity, 501c3. There was a lot of change in leadership transition going on as I was on the board, and I felt this calling to step into it and become the voice and face of it for a while, or, you know, what, actually so far longer than I had anticipated at the beginning, but I'm not done. Because it's a really, really exciting time. I feel like Hedgebrook is coming to its own in the world in a way that I think is going beyond, what I've anticipated, what our founder Nancy Nordoff anticipated. I mean, all of us, I think, are just kind of blown away by, this place that had been quietly supporting, nurturing, cultivating women writers and their voices for a quarter of a century now, you know, and is continuing to do that, but has opened up now as this like platform, megaphone, you know, of women's voices in the world over the last few years. And we're seeing the impact of that now in ways that are so exciting to me. And I think the conversation and feminism in the culture and this idea of needing and wanting to hear equally from women in order for the kind of change, positive change, to happen in the world, you know, that we need to see. And Hedgebrook's been doing that quietly, and now there's this tipping point that's happening where we're all acknowledging that if women are half the population of the world, but their voices are not equally heard, that's a big part of what's not right right now. And it, I feel very hopeful about it right now and very energized, because I'm seeing how very quickly things change when people start to hear each other's stories. Take marriage equality. You know, I really feel like so many activists and people have been working, and allies and gay people have been working for so long for that to happen. And all of a sudden in the last few years, boom, 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 you're seeing it just happen so quickly.
Right.
Because of all of that work. But then there's a point where, and for me, I think it's really started to happen when our straight allies, our families and friends, started realizing that it's not enough just to say, I accept you and I love you for who you are. They actually needed to start saying publicly, they needed to come out too as family and friends of gay people and say, not only do I accept and love my sister or my daughter or my grandchild or my friend, I need you to accept and this person too. And I need this person to have the same rights as I have. And that was a groundswell. And then all of a sudden, like, here we are here, Ireland, just a couple of weeks ago, Catholic country, unanimously by popular vote, has claimed gay marriage. And by popular vote, you know, I was blown away by that. But again, it's like when you call people out and say, you know, do you really believe that people should not, every human being should not have equal rights, equal space to be who they are as a human being on the planet, equal opportunity, you know? Should we, is it okay for one group of people to hold another group of people down? Pretty much people don't think that that should be the way it is, you know? And when you help people shift their consciousness around that, change happens very quickly. And, you know, I'm focused right now, and I think we all are, on racial equity. And I just really hope that we see a shift in that, you know, quickly, because the tragedies that are happening, we can't go on that way, you know? Yeah. And I feel like it's on us who are, have white privilege, who are not, you know, people of color, to come together. And again, like we did with marriage equality, to say, it is not okay for young black men to be under attack. You know, it's not okay for what happened in Charleston to happen a few weeks ago. And we feel bad about it, but we have to do more than feel bad about it. We have to write about it. We have to talk and have the uncomfortable conversations with within our own families about it. You know, I think social media is kind of a great place where that happens.
Absolutely.
You know, because people are putting their opinions right out there. And if you can actually have a civil conversation around it, then, yeah, it's really interesting to see how that can play out. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we'll move forward. I want to be part of that.
Shifting gears a little bit. That was profound. And now I feel like any segue is going to be awkward, but
you'll make it happen.
I will make it happen. I like to ask actors that come on the podcast what roles are on their bucket list. So what roles are on your bucket list?
What roles to act?
Now that you're back in the acting game.
Goodness, I want to do more Shakespeare. I'm just like loving it. Be really fun to do King Lear.
Yeah.
You know, Hamlet would be great. I mean, Hamlet would be awesome. It would be great. But I mean, you know, I'm a little older to play Hamlet now. But that's such a great question, because I haven't really. Well, Fun Home. I would so love to do that role.
I'm doing it. Oh my gosh! I'm like through this entire interview, I'm like looking at you and seeing that part. I'm saying this right now that I want to direct you in that role,
okay.
In that musical.
Boom. Heard it, folks. You heard it here.
Done. You heard it here on the podcast.
It so needs to happen. And I just...
Don't you think Whidbey will... I mean, Anne Medlock, who's a fantastic writer and who's on the Hushbrook board, what is she was saying? Or people call South Whidbey the Isle of Lesbos? Is this... that's the first time I had heard that.
That is so
but
funny.
I'm like, that totally, that
it's
like,
so not true. Well, I mean, I guess it is to some extent, but it's so funny.
But I'm like, people would love that musical here, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just, oh my gosh, that song that the girls sing.
The Ring of Keys.
Oh my gosh, yeah. That song. I have never seen on stage a young woman, I've never seen anybody describing that moment of... As a young gay person, of seeing someone who's older be that person that you are attracted to and that you want to be, like seeing that person walk into the room and just describing so beautifully what seeing the boots that she's wearing and this ring of keys on her belt loop and just like how that she's just like, oh my God, I want to be you. That's, you know, so beautiful, so beautiful. And so exactly how it feels, you know?
Yeah.
But to have it be this like private moment for this girl where she can't tell anyone because, right? She can't, because she's Alison Bechdel's my age. That's not a time when we could,
right?
You know, sing that song out loud, you know?
And I think it's
I just feel like my soul is singing with her.
I know.
You know? It's just so beautiful.
I get teared up every time I listen to that song. Mm. It's interesting. Last weekend, I saw it was a collaboration between Reboot Theater Company and Seattle Musical Theater. They did an all-female cast of 1776, the musical. And it wasn't that they were in drag. Mm. It was just they were women playing the parts. They raised the money so that all of the costumes were built specifically for those actors.
Wow.
And it was one of the most powerful pieces of theater I had seen, because it completely amazing. Opened that up to me. I've talked about this before, but I was lucky enough to play Pirelli in a production of Sweeney Todd.
Oh, how fun.
And
I could so see you.
When Max was saying, Matt, I interviewed my friend Max on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, "You're the most beautiful Italian man I've ever seen." But sort of cracking that open as a female actress who's been locked, you know, for so many years, just locked into, okay, you can be the pretty girl or you can be like the quirky character actress, and those are your two options forever and ever. Mm-hmm. And how musicals like Fun Home are opening that up, and and producers were like, let's do an all female company of 1776 are opening that up, and how that sort of changes what the bucket list is as performers. Because I love musical theater so much, and I saw someone posted a supercut of a bunch of You Got Trouble from The Music Man. I'm like, yeah, I want to play Harold Hill. Yeah. Like, I played Marion. That was fun. Now I want to play Harold Hill. And I hope that, I don't know, as we keep going on, that more producers make those choices to re-examine these pieces of musical theater, and then people who are making new work get to open it up that way. And I think Seattle's a really great place. The new play community and all the playwrights and playwrights / performers / directors.
Right.
It's just a juicy place to be right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it just, you know, it just, again, working on Prospero, just shifting that lens.
Right.
I mean, it's actually hard for me to see Prospero as male right now, of course, because I'm in it, but the different layers and complexities of this role as female makes so much sense to me. It almost feels like it's what Shakespeare had in mind. You know, and interestingly, all of the roles would have been performed by men in his time.
Right.
Right? And so, and I like it that Rose hasn't done it as an all-female. I think it's really interesting, the dynamics between the genders, again, as having the shipwreck and the you know, having all of the people coming onto the island, but coming on as strangers and foreigners in this land, is really interesting. But I love what you're saying, because I just think it's it just causes you to look at the story and in like 1776 the history just from a completely different vantage point. And that can only be good. You know, that can only
be cool.
I want you to ask me that question again, though. I feel like acting is so new to me at this point, coming back into it, that I haven't even thought yet about other roles. And Prospero is such a huge role, you know, that ask me that in a few months and I'll have a whole list for you.
Okay, I'll come back. I'm going to come back to you. As we're wrapping this up, I like to sort of close with asking, what advice would you give to people who are aspiring to be playwrights or actors, or maybe actors who want to write plays or playwrights who want to act, or any answer to that jumble of a question?
Yeah, I think about this a lot, actually. And I think about it in terms right now in my writing and with Hedgebrook too, of I think women really struggle with putting ourselves out there because there's danger in that, because you want to be seen, and we don't often feel seen in the culture. And I think there's a fear of rejection. And I've been thinking a lot about rejection, because I get rejected a lot with sending my play. I mean, the more you put your stuff out, the more you're going to experience that, because you're not going to get everything you put yourself out for, right? But really, I'm working on shifting my relationship with that, because even the notion of rejection says that you're giving someone else the power to tell you if your work is good or not. And nobody else has the power to tell you that. And nobody else has the power to tell you, you know, this is your one life on the planet, in this incarnation anyway, right? And so make it what you want it to be. Like, grasp what you want. Go for what you want. Any barriers you think are created by somebody else, those are your barriers only if you claim them and let them be. Nobody else has that power over you. And I feel like women, we give our power away all the time. And you know, it's been a lesson for me to say, hey, I'm a playwright. Okay, I'm going to write a play and put it out there, you know, or to say to Rose, I want to act again, you know, I want to play one of the big male roles. I don't want it, you know, and to have those things happen. And I really do believe that we manifest who we are and what our life is and what we want it to be by the stories we tell ourselves and by the boundaries that we either set in order to keep our space, you know, and have our power, or the boundaries we let other people fence us in with, you know, and you can have as big a life as you want to have. Nobody else can give that to you and nobody else can take it away from you. So go have it.
That is profound and a fantastic button for this interview. So folks, you're going to want to do three things. And the three things you're going to want to do is you're going to want to go see Whizzer Pizzer, 12th Avenue Arts, produced by Theater 22, running July 10th through August 1st. You're going to want to see Amy Wheeler as Prospero in The Tempest, directed by Rose Woods, opening July 17th, running through early September. And you're going to want to visit Hedgebrook's website and apply for a writer's in residency and check out all the cool stuff that's going on there too.
Yes.
So do all those three things, please.
Do those things.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Katie. It's been delightful as always. Thanks.